Okay. 22nd chapter of Ezekiel. Specifically now, he's going to talk about Jerusalem and the judgment on Jerusalem. Remember, at the end of chapter 21, he talks about that he's going to judge the king. And the king at that time, on your list there, the last king, Zedekiah. And the judgment of God was going to fall upon him. He will be taken. History tells us, and I think you find this also in the Chronicles or the Kings, that history says that he was taken, his eyes were gouged out, and he was taken to Babylon, and there he died in captivity. Which is basically the last king in the line of David. And in fulfillment of Ezekiel's prophecy, he says that the scepter is going to be taken out of the hand until it's placed into the hand of one who comes and who will rule righteously. And we know that to be Messiah. Okay? So, verse 1 of chapter 22, we'll read through verse 5. It says, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Now, son of man, will you judge that bloody city? Yes, show her all her abominations. Then say, Thus saith the Lord, The city sheds blood in her own midst, that her time may come, and she makes idols within herself to defile herself. You have become guilty by the blood which you have shed, and have defiled yourself with the idols which you have made. You have caused your days to draw near, and have come to the end of your years. Therefore, I have made you a reproach to the nations, and a mockery to all countries, those near and those far. From you will mock you as infamous and full of tumult." I want you to see what I think, if I could put it this way, what could possibly be going on in the heart of God as he has to tell Ezekiel to tell the people this. His heart has to be broken. I hope that we never have a view of our Heavenly Father as some mighty being up there that gets some sort of thrill out of punishing people. He doesn't. Clearly, the Bible makes it so clear. He has such a heart for people. He loves his creation. So much so, he sent his son, his only son, to die for us. I mean, how can you display any greater love for people than that? And so when you read this, I hope that you will see that God is having to pronounce judgment upon his holy city. This is his holy city. This is where he told them to go. He told them to build a temple there. He told them that this would be the place where he would meet them. It's an incredible place. Okay? And now he has to say that this city that was intended to be Jerusalem, the place of peace, is not. He closes out that last part I read as a place of tumult, rejection, disobedience to God. A place not of peace, but a place of, how do you describe it, a bloodshed. As you read the minor prophets that are contemporary with Ezekiel, prior to the fall of Jerusalem and Judah and Jerusalem, you see that the charge that they continually bring against the city is the same, against Judah is the same. They mistreat the widows. They mistreat the orphans. They neglect the poor. There's no justice. The justice is that you can get in the city is the justice that you can afford to buy. Okay? There is the bloodshed that goes on in the city. Murder that goes on in the city. Cheating people financially that goes on in the city. The killing of infants, where God specifically warned them, and in my daily Bible reading, I'm in Deuteronomy now, and again, in Deuteronomy, God tells Moses to remind them all the things that they've been through and what he's called them to. And one of the things he said, when you go into the land that I'm going to give you, you need to drive these people out. And God even said, it's going to be a process. It's not going to happen immediately, but it's going to be a process. And he says, you're going to be inclined. He tells them, you're going to be inclined to want to say, what are these gods that these people are worshiping? And wouldn't it be a good thing if we joined them in this? And God said, don't you do that. You drive them out, because these are the kind of people that will sacrifice their own children to the god Molech. And if you join with them, you'll find yourself there. And I'm going to guarantee you something, that the Israelites, when that warning came out from Moses, would say, here's what they would say. The same thing we would say a lot of times. Well, there's no way that I would ever do that. right? Their response to God would be, there's no way, God, we would ever sacrifice our children. But now, they've come to that place, to the place where they are sacrificing their own children, where even in the holy city, or just what would be the old city, just outside the holy city, you have in a valley which is called, Jesus calls Gehenna, you'd have them set up the idol of the god Molech, and they would take their babies out there and they would sacrifice their babies on the red hot arms of this god, these living babies, and somehow consider that to be some sort of act of worship and receive some sort of grace from this false god by doing such as this. Again, let me tell you that if you were to ask them, are you guys followers of Yahweh, you know what their answer would be? Even in the midst of that, their answer would still be yes. The first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. We talked about this. That does not simply mean before him in priority. It also means, and we don't get this a lot, we don't think of this, we think of no other gods before me, that means you don't worship other gods other than God. That's the way we look at it. But you need to understand the fullness of what he's saying there, even in the Hebrew, and that is that you shall have no other gods before me, in my presence. It's not enough to say, well, I'm a believer in God, but I also believe in this other thing. God is saying, the first commandment is, you will have no other gods in my presence. There are no other gods, and you will worship, you will serve, you will not do anything with any other god. You'll have no other gods before me. You get that? Usually the word before there we throw in as a place of priority. And he's really saying, before me, in my presence. No other gods in my presence. And so the prophets, not only the major prophet like Ezekiel, but the minor prophets kept telling them, the bloodshed, the injustice, the treatment of the poor, the treatment of the widows, the treatment of the orphans. You're to be the people of God and you're treating people this way and you're bringing judgment down upon your head. And here again, God is saying this through Ezekiel. It's an incredible thing. The city of the king has now become, what's he say, a bloody city. A bloody city. The city that should have been, that was the place where God resided in the Holy of Holies among his people, were to be a light to the whole world. Now, what's he say? Has become a reproach to the whole world. And the world looks at you and they mock you. And they have nothing to do with you. You have a real picture in the extreme here of Old Testament hypocrisy, where the world looks at Jerusalem and Judah and says, you say that you're followers of God, but there's no evidence that you're followers of God. See, a hypocrite is someone who says they believe something and they follow something, but when you look at their life, they intentionally do not follow it. A hypocrite is not a Christian who stumbles. We all stumble. It's part of our testimony. I stumble. And by the grace of God, he forgives me. And I don't want to stumble. But I do. But a hypocrite is someone who puts out this persona that they are something or that they believe something, but they have no intention of following. That's a hypocrite. And what he's saying here is you have played the hypocrite to the extreme. You claim to be the children of God, the chosen people of God, yet there's no evidence in your lives that God has any real place. And so the world looks at you and they mock you. He said you become a reproach to the nations rather than a blessing. And they mock you. And guys, that's the same way that many people look at the church today. And some people say, well, that's not justified. But I would say across the board, there's a lot of justification there. We've got to stop acting like a lost world. We've got to start being that peculiar people, the redeemed. And in that there's no room for self righteousness. It really is a place of humility. It's a place of love and caring. A lot of times when the world talks about the church, they're justified in what they say about the church, and that's the shame. If they're going to not like us, let it be that they don't like us because we love God and we follow Jesus. You know, there's enough people out there who won't like you because of that. You need to understand that, okay? I always tell people, the Bible says that the message of the cross that we are to share and that we are to live is an offense to those who are perishing. You can't help that. They will be offended by that. But don't you and I be the offense. See, you understand the difference? I know some people that are very offensive to the world out there, and they say, "Oh, I'm just suffering for Jesus." And no, you're just being a jerk. And it's not only the world that doesn't like you, most of the church don't like what you're doing. Don't you be the offense. You know, what you want people to do is say, you know what? You know one thing I don't like about Miss Ruth is she's a Christian. And that she loves the Lord. I can't stand everything Jesus about this lady. Good. That's what they should say. But you don't want them to say, well, we don't like Miss Ruth because she says she believes in Jesus, but we saw her down doing this or saying this or, and you know, and I know you didn't do that. I'm just using you. You're sitting there. Okay. All right. You understand the difference there. You know, and sometimes when we want to walk in, quote, righteousness, our statements that we think come from a place of righteousness actually come from a heart filled with hate and self-righteousness, that we're right and the rest of the world is wrong, and so we're gonna condemn them to hell because they don't see the same things we do. You know. So, let your light shine among so men that they see, so among men that they see Jesus in you, and they glorify your Father who's in heaven. Now remember, the word glorify means to make known. And remember what God said about glorify. I'll be glorified through your obedience or your disobedience. He'll be made known by you. So the world might see the light of Christ in you, and they will glorify God. That doesn't mean they're going to accept God. It doesn't mean they're going to love God. It means they're going to know that God is, even if they don't like it. You know, that's my big thing about atheists. I talk to a lot of atheists. I do it on purpose. Try not to be offensive. I know I can be. My one question, I said, boy, you are fighting awful hard about a being that you don't even believe exists.
Yep, right.
Talk about insanity.
Yes.
You know, if something doesn't exist and I really believe it doesn't exist, why would I waste my effort?
Absolutely.
You know, it doesn't make, if God doesn't exist, it doesn't matter. So, anyways, and is that offensive? Okay. I'm thinking on Miss Ruth, and she's going to move back there from now on. Whoever sits here gets it. Okay, Bill, you're next. Okay, all right. So you see the indictment that God brings against Ruth, and please see it again. I want you to see this from a place of a broken heart. God intended for them to be His people and to glorify Himself through them living in Him and touch every nation. And the opposite is true. Questions or comments? Verse 1 through 5. All right, let's read on. Verses 6 through 12. And again, a lot of this is repeated, so we'll be moving quicker than normal. Right. So, said, look, the princes of Israel, each one has used his power to shed blood in you. In you they have made light of father and mother. In your midst they have oppressed the stranger. In you they have mistreated the fatherless and the widow. See the indictment again. Again, I'm going to tell you, read the minor prophets. Every minor prophet says the exact same thing. And now we have a major prophet, Ezekiel. By the way, another major prophet, Isaiah. And another major prophet, Jeremiah. All of them, same, almost identical words. Okay, and by the way, before we move on, I just want you to see, how does verse 7 begin? What's it say?
In you.
Huh? Well, in you, but what's the first thing? What's he deal with? Father and mother. Any significance to that? That you can think of? Someone share. What would be the significance of him tying in father and mother along with how you treat strangers, how you treat the poor, how you treat the widows, how you treat the orphans? Why would he bring father and mother into this? Anybody have an idea?
How you treat your father and mother.
Okay, but what's the significance of that?
You're right.
If you think about it, it is the first commandment. Moses makes a great deal of it. It is the first commandment with a promise. Honor your father and your mother that your days may be long upon this earth. You know what that days may be long means? It doesn't mean that a guaranteed long life. That is, again, is another Hebrew idiom which means that your days may be filled with blessings. Okay? And it was so important, as you read the Pentateuch, the portion of the law, that someone who, a rebellious son, was actually to be put to death. It's an incredible statement, right? And every society that has gone before and has fallen falls at this point, where there is lack of care, lack of honor, lack of recognition of fathers and mothers. I would say even throwing their elderly people that so I think that's part of why he talks about it. He goes now verse 8, he goes, you have despised my holy things. That would, holy things mean those things that God says are sacred. They have made them, they have profaned them, they have made them dirty, right? And profane my Sabbath. So what have they done? They have neglected the Sabbath. They've neglected the Sabbath, all of the Sabbath. There's a Sabbath for the Jewish people. There's a Sabbath each week. You understand that? It's a seventh day. For the Jewish people, there are special Sabbaths that are tied around each of the feasts. Special called days of rest that are tied with the Sabbath. And for the Jewish people, there are Sabbath years. Moses instructed them, 6 years you will work the land. On the seventh year, you will let the land rest. They did not do that. And the truth is, Jeremiah tells us, for 490 years, they did not keep the Sabbath year. That's 77, that works out to 70 years in total that they didn't. Out of 490, every seventh year, 70 years. You know how long they were in captivity? 70 years. Okay? What's incredible here is, man says, I'm not going to keep the Sabbath. God says, yes, you are. Man thinks that we're more powerful than God. We're not more powerful than God. So God gave the land its Sabbath rest. But instead of it being every 7 years, where, by the way, if they'd listened to God, their crops would have been greater than they were. Because if you work the land all, you know this, how many of you from a farm family at all? Okay, I am. My dad worked on farm for a lot of years. If you work the land all the time, if you try to grow stuff in the same land all the time, you pull all the nutrients out of the thing and you get to where the land cannot produce anything. So what do? We start pumping in all this artificial stuff to make the land do what it would probably do if they just let it rest. Okay? And then what do we do with that? Then we stuff our face with all this food that comes out of this stuff filled with pesticides and chemicals and all this stuff, and you and I don't have any idea how much chemicals we have in our bodies. I'm convinced that it is the cause of so much cancer in human beings. Our air, our water, our food, it's just filled with junk, and we don't know what it is. So. All right, so they despise the Sabbath, they profane the Sabbath. Again, that goes back to one of the commandments. Remember the Sabbath day and do what? Keep it holy. Set it apart. That's what that word keep it holy means. Set it apart from any other day. And that was a direct commandment that was given to specifically the day given to the Israelites. And later on in Exodus, Moses said, the Sabbath is a sign between God and you, Israel. Nine. In you are men who slander to cause bloodshed. In you are those who eat on the mountains. In you are the myths who commit lewdness. All right? So, guys, don't ever eat on a mountain. That's what... You know what he's talking about? First of all, men who slander to cause bloodshed. When you lose a sense of the value of human life, then it does not bother you to do anything or say anything. When you just, when human life has no value, you can just cut it off for no reason at all. You know, think about a lot of our TV shows, a lot of our life is nothing. You know, you walk in, someone shoots somebody or cuts somebody up or something like that. But that actually happens in real life. And that's when you see a society is in real trouble, where we become so callous about these things that really, oh, so-and-so got killed. It doesn't seem to touch us much anymore. He goes on to say, you who eat on the mountains. Well, what was tied with the mountains? Idolatry. It's not a location, whether you eat on the mountain or eat on the valley. That term is always tied with the idolatry of the pagans that were in the land. And the things that they would eat would go back even to what Paul talked about. Eat things that were offered as sacrifices to idols. God was so specific, again, in giving Moses commandments. He said, you know what? You don't even touch those things that they had. You don't eat those things that they had. And if I lead you to a place where you destroy a city, I read this morning, he said, you take all the booty that you get there, you pile it up and you burn it, and you do not take any of it into your own house. You know, and we would say something like, well, how can an inanimate object cause trouble? You know, it's gold. We got to keep the gold. And God says, no, you don't take any of it into your house. Okay. But why? Because you know what it is.
Yeah. We bring it in our homes all the time.
Yeah.
Pornography is a big one.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things in the world, and we assume that these things will not harm us.
Right, yeah, they do.
And they do.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, he goes on to say, in the midst, they commit lewdness. And when he says in the midst, it just means there's no shame anymore. You commit what? Lewdness. You reveal things that should only be revealed between a husband and wife. You talk about things that only should be talked about. You cheapen the beauty that God meant for all of that, including the sexual relationships and those special things that He intended just for a husband and wife. And you present those in such a way as if it becomes a norm that this is the right. And again, any society does this. If you did some study on even Rome had moved completely to the place where people were just public nudity, public lewdness. And now we find even in our country public nudity and public lewdness. I mean, people doing stuff just out in the public. You say, my goodness. All right. So there's not a whole lot of difference between, if you haven't caught it yet, between our own country and where this country was when God finally says that's enough. Okay. Verse 10, in you men uncover their father's nakedness. In you they violate women who are set apart during their impurity. So, if you remember that it was a sin of Ham with Noah. Okay? Uncovering their father's nakedness. Shaming their father. You know, with Ham, he did not cover up his father. He went in and he viewed his father that way. He always thought about, well, Noah got drunk, and he did. Noah got drunk. He's laying there naked. His son does not cover him up. So his son does not, I don't want to say, did not protect his father. Even in his father's shortcomings, he did not protect his father. Okay? But the other two, what did they do? They backed in. They would not even look at their father, and they covered up their father's nakedness because they didn't want their father to be shamed. And he talks about that here, and he also talks about they violate women in their impurity and stuff. And again, that falls back to the Mosaic law, as you've read that in the book of Leviticus and stuff, that a man is not to have relationships with his wife while she's during that time of her period. That's an impurity. That's how he describes it and stuff. Matter of fact, she's considered at that point, because there's blood being shed, as being unclean. And any time there's blood being shed, whether it's human or animal blood, it's considered unclean. And impurity is what he uses there. Okay? Verse 11. One commits an abomination with his neighbor's wife. Another lewdly defiles his daughter-in-law. Another in you violates his sister, his father's daughter. All restraint has been cast aside. Anything goes. Sound familiar to you? Anything goes. I always thought one of the great indicators of our society, from a man's perspective, I guess, I don't know how you women feel about that, is to watch. And I can't watch them, but is to watch the soap operas. Anybody ever watch soap operas? Anybody want to confess to that? Okay. If you watch a soap opera, by the time maybe a couple years are over, everybody on there has slept with everybody else on there. And it's an incredible thing. I think the last time I watched something was when I was in college. We were nuts. We'd run, General Hospital's on. We'll go see what's going on with Luke and Laura. So we run over there, and in the dorms, all these Baptist kids are watching Luke and Laura, you know. But then you turn on their shows now, like, and there's the same people, been there for 30 years. They're 30 years older, but they're still doing the same thing they were doing 30 years ago. And by that time, everybody has been married to or slept with everybody a dozen times. You know what I'm talking about? And people fill their minds with this, and talked about pornography. And the truth is that by far men have a greater issue with pornography that you find in the nudity of women and the thing than women do. But I would say to you, by far women have more problems with what I'd call mental pornography when it comes to these fantasies of, oh, if my life could just be like Laura's life or this type of thing. It's the same thing. A lot of romance novels are nothing but softcore porn, but you don't want me to tell you that, but I'm going to tell you that, you know, because it moves you into a place of fantasy, because life is not like that. You know, and that's the same thing that when men look at pornography, that's the same thing, ladies. I know it's hard for you to maybe perceive that. That's the same thing. It moves them into a place of fantasy with that picture, because life is not like that. And that's why it's so deceptive for men. And it can grab a hold of a man, and it can, we want to say it's addictive. It's sin that takes them captive. That's what you need to understand. You know, and I deal with some wives and stuff that they cannot understand that, because they think it directly reflects upon them. And it does directly impact them. But it's not necessarily a reflection upon them. It is a fantasy that men have that is a dangerous fantasy. I'm not excusing, I'm just trying to explain to you that men are very visual creatures. And women are very, for the most part, are very emotional creatures. That's why the soap operas touch women's hearts more than they do men, because it's emotional. It's feeling. It's what it is. You know. Yeah. There you go. That will not be on tape. Okay. All right. So I want you to get that. But the point is, whether it comes from one or the other, when a society moves to a place where these things become acceptable. I mean, you hear things like a child would get in more trouble today carrying a Bible into school than carrying a Playboy into school. Then you know society is starting to turn, or has turned. You know, when we make excuses for these things, society's in trouble. You know, I've heard even Christian men say, well, all men look at it. So, brother, does that make it right? All men struggle with it. That doesn't make it right. We've got to be careful. You know, one preacher said, I think it was in the 80s when I just entered the ministry, he said, if the church is not careful, what you see in the world as acceptable in 10 years will be acceptable in the church also. And that has happened in a lot of cases. And that's a sad thing, because it reflects the exact same thing that's happened as we're reading here in Israel. All restraint is gone. Even to a place where a brother lays down with his sister. A father lays down with his daughter-in-law. I mean, just, you know. Verse 12. In you they take bribes to shed blood. You take usury and increase. You made profit from your neighbors by extortion and have forgotten me, says the Lord God. Now, what's he talking about here? Usury. What is usury?
Extremely high interest.
It's extremely high interest. Okay, and it's interesting that when God again spoke to Moses, he told them that you are not allowed to charge this kind of interest. You're not allowed to use usury against another person. He calls it, it's contrary to what God would want. And he says the reason you do this is because you have forgotten me. basically you say, well, what about loaning and stuff? And I, if you read the book of Proverbs, Proverbs got some pretty great wisdom about loaning stuff, you know, and being a, even a co-signer for loans, it warns you against that and stuff, you know. So be careful of that. You co-sign a loan. You understand? You co-sign a loan. If they default on a loan, your name's next. And they will come against you. You know, I've had people say, well, what do you think about that, Pastor? I say, you know what? There must be a reason why the bank would not have them give them this loan unless you co-sign.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so if you're going to co-sign for a loan, expect to pay for that.
They just give it to them.
Expect that you're going to give it to them. Now, if they, that doesn't always happen. I understand that. So you've been blessed if they do it. But expect to pay for it. Okay. Verse 13, behold, therefore I beat my fist at the dishonest profit which you have made, and at the bloodshed which you have been, which has been in your midst. So God is saying, I stand against this. Can your heart endure, or can your hand remain strong in the days when I shall deal with you? I, the Lord, have spoken, and I will do it. That is a statement of imminent judgment. And I want you to get that. And here's what he says he's going to do. What will he do? I will scatter you among the nations, disperse you throughout the countries, and remove your filthiness completely from you. So, he's not going to allow them to be in a corporate sense together to do these things. It's very interesting if you look at this. God has done this. He does it here. He allows them to come back again. Okay? And he uses a family at this time by the name, you've heard the name Maccabees.
Yes.
And God raises up this warrior family, and he uses them to bring the people back into the land and to fight off a man by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes and reestablish the temple and cleanse the temple and all these kind of things. God is gracious to bring them back. But it isn't long till again they're far away from him, and that's the time when Jesus comes the first time. And when Christ walks among them, when Jesus walks among them, they look into the face of God and they don't even recognize him. Yet they would tell you that they were God's people. I think about God, the religious leaders of that day stood in the face of God in the flesh and argued with him about truth. Because they didn't recognize him. It tells you, to me, what was the job of the high priest? Remember, we talked about this. The high priest was to go into the Holy of Holies, and there he met God face to face. Ezekiel talks, and we've looked about it, about a time when the Spirit of God leaves the temple. There's never, ever another verse that says Shekinah ever returned to the temple. God raises up Zerubbabel. He rebuilds the temple. Herod enhances and makes the temple very beautiful to be the temple in the time of Jesus. But you never again have it spoken of in the scripture that Shekinah dwelt in the temple, in the Holy of Holies. And I don't believe that he did. Because I can tell you that in the time of Jesus, the high priest was a man by the name of Caiaphas. Caiaphas was a very zealous religious man, but he did not know God. How do I know that? Again, I would tell you, he looked in the very face of the Messiah, of God in the flesh, and he condemned him to death. So he was able to go into the Holy of Holies and nothing happened. By the time that you get there, it was nothing but a religious ritual that took place. Okay? So God says, I'm going to scatter you. He brings them back. And then after the crucifixion of Jesus and you know, starting after the turn of the first century, you have again the dispersion that takes place. And for almost 2,000 years, the Jewish people are dispersed all over the world. Yet for 2,000 years, they remain an identifiable ethnic group. I'm not even an identifiable ethnic group. I don't even know what I am. I just say I'm Heinz 57. Okay? So, but God holds them as his people, even throughout all the nations. And then in 1948, shall a nation be born in a day? I guess so, it did. And he begins to bring them back. And he brings them back with all the things they've learned from all the different nations they've been in. And again, I've shared with you this before. It's what makes Israel a first world nation surrounded by a bunch of third world countries. because they brought back all the technology, all the knowledge, all the things that they'd learned in all these places. And Israel is set apart, head and shoulders above any nation around them. Peter.
Why is it that they're so... they're so distinguishable. Why is it that
they kept their traditions. Anybody seen Fiddler on the Roof? Tradition. Okay, they kept their tradition. These things were such a part of them, and God always kept a group. And I'm not even saying He kept them in belief that Jesus is Messiah, but I always believe that God kept a group that would keep the Jewish people, for lack of a better term, Jewish wherever God had them, in Europe, even America, in Russia, wherever He had them. It's an interesting phenomenon, and I don't know that I can answer it except. Part of it has to be the hand of God to keep that identifiable group identifiable to fulfill what He promised that He would do.
Don't Mary. I think, at least on the surface, one thing they really got is that they were God's chosen people.
Oh, yeah.
Never let go of that phrase, where there's no other nationality that was ever declared to be God's chosen people.
That's a part of it, yeah.
Still believe.
Yeah.
God chose us.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
As far as them being recognizable, when you're going over to, are they recognizable as far as how they look here?
No, it's not a look. It's not a look. It's more of an ethnic, cultural background. Okay, because there are. In Ethiopia, there are Jewish people with skin as black as the coffee pot. I met them when I went over to Israel.
I was just wondering, is that maybe that you can see where there was the 12 tribes and certain tribes have a certain?
No, that's a good question. Usually they don't even know what tribe they're in. If you try to break it down to tribal thing, now it's mostly Jewish people, a Jewish heritage. You know, if someone says their last name is Levi, I kind of know what tribe they're in. You know, but even a lot of Jewish people have changed. Like a lot of Jewish people with the name Green are actually Jewish, and it's Greenberg, or but they've dropped the Berg off for convenience sake and stuff. One of the baseball players last name Green, that's what he did and stuff. So it's more of an ethnic. And a cultural and religious thing.
But in general, sometimes if you're walking and you see someone, sometimes there seems to be a distinction when you just visibly look at them before you get into the rest.
Yeah,
that's just what we see here in America versus you go to another country and they may have another kind of distinct appearance.
Yeah, and you would have, but the thing is there are European Jews, there are Middle Eastern Jews. And there are African Jews, and all of them would have a different appearance.
So when you're in Israel and you see the Jewish guys with the curls,
there's no problem pointing them out. Yeah, that is the Orthodox, or they're also called the Hasidic Jews. Okay, but they're ultra Orthodox. They don't even fit. They would consider you just profane them by just calling them Orthodox. They are ultra-Orthodox.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So when they go to the Wailing Wall and they're banging their head against the wall, what's all that about?
Well, they believe that is the most holy site in all of Israel.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the Wailing Wall is actually not a wall of the temple. It is actually a retaining wall of the Temple Mount. Okay, but it was not destroyed. When Titus came in and destroyed the temple in AD 70, it wasn't destroyed. So, as they've exposed more and more of the Wailing Wall, or the what we also call the Western Wall, that has become a very holy place for them. They consider it the closest place to God. They do not appreciate now. The ultra Orthodox do not appreciate you Gentiles going over there and touching their wall.
Exactly.
You don't. They don't. First of all, they don't even want you in Israel. They do not want you in Israel. And they do not, most of the Hasidic Jews do not care for what they would call the secular government of Israel even today. Most of them do not like Netanyahu. They've not liked anybody who was a prime minister because theirs is mostly based on what they see going back to, they would say the Tanakh, they would say the Pentateuch, they would say, you know, those things, and they take things very literally. You'll see them, they have the box of scripture on their head. If they were to take off their jacket, you would see that they would have a piece of leather wrapped around their arm very tight and pull it tighter so they could remember. They have, if you notice a lot of times underneath their black coat, you will see this white thing with tassels on it.
Yeah.
It's a prayer shawl. You know, and they wear that on them all the time. So.
So do they also stick the prayers in the Western world?
No, I. You know what the truth is, and I'm gonna say none of them do, but I do not believe that the and Hasidic Jew would stick a prayer in the, their thing that they would stay there, and they're not really banging their head against the wall. They're bowing to the wall and they say their prayers. They read the Tanakh, they read the Pentateuch, and they're reading it as they read it. They're bowing down. With each, they're trying. It's kind of like with each word, they're trying to bow to God.
Yeah.
So.
And it's still tradition because we're getting ready to celebrate Passover.
Yeah.
And during Passover, especially with the Friday night when we light the Shabbat candles, it's the same thing. The women gather around, and I get to be included, and we close our eyes and we bow and we say our bracha, and it's the same thing. So it is just tradition. And I'll bring those, I can't even pronounce it,
phylacteries.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I got
and if you go into a Jewish home, they have, what are those called? Were they?
Mezuzah.
See?
I got a mezuzah.
And there is the scripture.
Yeah.
It's a blessing upon the home. You put them on your doorpost. You put them on your forehead. Okay. Another question. Did you have another thing?
Well, I just wanted to then see. Is it just the visitors that put those prayers in the
whale? Yes, most of them are.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. You know what?
Well,
no, see, I'll probably get in trouble, but.
Yeah.
I'm always in trouble.
What's new?
I've been to Israel, and it's usually the Gentiles who do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm right what? You don't know what I'm about to say. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing beneficial of it. Okay. I had one lady on my second trip. She goes, we went to the Jordan. We always have a baptism in the Jordan River. She said, I've got to get some of that holy water. I said, listen, that is the nastiest water I've ever seen. There's nothing holy about that water. It's nasty river water is what it is.
That's right.
You know, and those you know people do things over there and stuff, and there's nothing wrong with it as long as we understand. But unfortunately, there are people that attribute some sort of grace to the water that's there, or some sort of grace to the wall that's there. And but there is something special about being over there. There's no doubt about that. Sandy, and now I'll come over here.
There's
Sandy.
An email address that you can send your prayer to them.
Oh.
They will put it in the wall.
Okay.
I haven't been there since 90, and I know when I was there, it was divided, and the women.
It is divided, and the women get a little section, and the men get a big section. And the women are not allowed in the men's section, and men who go in that section have to have their head covered. You have to wear a hat, or they provide paper yarmulkes to put on your head. So.
So those Jews, when they're there, it's very hard for them because that's their land.
Oh yeah.
If they're following the word, all these other Gentiles should really not be in there.
Not from their perspective. You're exactly right. And last time we went, there was a
holy of holy things. Because
right.
That's tainting it, and so that's using a lot of restraint on their end because it is very. They're still waiting for him to come.
Right. Last time we were there, we went into the men's section by the western wall, and there was a Hasidic Jew sitting right there, and he was cursing us as we walked in. You Gentiles do not belong here. You shouldn't be here. And he cursed us as we walked in and stuff, the men who walked in and stuff. And he believes that. He believes we should not be there. They show no reliance, even to the United States, where the United States is a great friend of Israel and has been for, but they don't see it that way. The Hasidic Jews do not. And you drive through their neighborhood, you're just as likely to get rocks thrown at your bus as drive through without it. So they don't want you there.
No.
Yeah, they tolerate you.
Every Passover, they open up the door for Eliyahu to come in, which is the the Elijah coming in before Christ. And one of these days, you're going to open that door, and he's going to be there.
So, Pastor, just to help me understand that, too, if he has this chosen land for them, and I know he comes back to reign, how does that then cross over to the Gentiles?
Well,
eventually he doesn't. I mean, eventually this is going to be just their land, right?
Well, see, that becomes a misunderstanding.
Yeah.
That becomes even a Jewish misunderstanding.
Yeah.
Because if you read the book of Isaiah, we go back to the Old Testament, God says, I have chosen you as my people, not so you can sit around and like people sometimes in churches, I'm a member of this church, I'm good.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what everybody else does. What did he call the church to be? To be his body that reaches out to the world and welcomes the foreigner. And what I mean by foreigner, I just mean the unbeliever in. And Isaiah says that God intended Israel to be the light unto the Gentile nations. He never intended for Israel to be the only nation that followed God. He intended Israel to be the light to the Gentile nation. So when that time comes, they will understand the fulfillment of what Isaiah said. It won't be a land, though they'll be back in the land and it will be their possession and stuff. It will be a land that's open. How do you describe a land without? He describes it a land with cities with no walls. Mm-hmm. By the way, you go there now and you see a huge wall between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, without walls. In other words, a welcoming land. Where Messiah will be there, and even the Gentile nations will be welcome.
So did that only come after Jesus?
Yes.
And that's what he said.
Yeah.
Originally, the land had boundaries, and that's what we're reading right now.
Well, yeah.
That as they go into this land, they're to drive everything. But they had followed the word. Would this truly have just been?
No. Yeah. What would?
You know what I mean? Because they were.
But here's the point. Here's the point of that. These are good questions because here's the point. God intended to cleanse the land so his people would be holy so that they could reach the nations. But as long as they left the land defiled, if they entered into the unholiness of those people that were there, and if you read, again, in Deuteronomy, I'd encourage you to read the first six chapters of Deuteronomy. God tells Moses and he tells the people exactly why he's having them destroy those other people. It's not because he hates them. It's not because he's not going to offer to Gentile nations salvation and stuff like he did to the Jewish nation. It's because they have so turned their backs upon God that God's going to use Israel to bring... God's going to judge them. Just the same way he's judging Israel, right? In what we're reading right here. But God's plan to judge them was to use Israel. And he wanted his people to be a holy people so that he could reach the other nations. But if they just came in and joined with the people, all the ites that are there, the whole list of ites that are there, and he said, this is what will happen. You'll become like them. You'll worship their gods. You'll do all these things. And you know what? They didn't do what God says, and that's exactly what happened, to the point that we have them right here. They're so, instead of being a testimony of God, what's he say? You become a reproach. You become a mockery. Just what God said would happen if they didn't go in and cleanse the land first happened. And so what? They're actually, if you think about it, right here, Israel's worse off than they were before. And by the way, it's the same way with us. If we've come to, that's why he talks about a Christian who returns to sin, it's like a dog who returns to its own vomit. If we come to the truth of who Jesus is, we receive the truth of who Jesus is, and we try to go back into the world, it's not, you can't go back to where you were. You know too much now.
That's right.
It will be even worse for you, and the result will be worse for you. So that's the point of cleansing the land, to be that nation that God intended for them to be. It wasn't just to exclude other nations. Because if you think about it, again, you read Moses, God allowed them to bring foreigners out of Egypt with them when they went into the land. There were Egyptians with them. And he said, if they choose to be with you and to follow me and stuff, you welcome them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not of Jacob's children. They were Egyptians. So God is always welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
But he won't welcome people. The unfortunate thing, even of the ecumenical, we're a little bit over time, sorry, but the unfortunate thing of even the ecumenical movement today is we want to welcome anybody where whatever they want to believe. And somehow we have this idea of a God who says, it's okay, you can believe whatever you want. You can believe Buddha, you can believe Muhammad, you can believe whatever you want, and let's just come together and have peace. Well, there will be no peace. There cannot be peace. Because we're not talking about just a philosophy of life. We're talking truth and that which is false. God always welcomed those, even way back then, who said, we want to follow God. And it didn't matter whether they were Jewish or not Jewish. God says, you bring them with you. And they'll receive the blessing of the land the same way you will. And ultimately, that's what God's going to do. He's going to bring us all home. And what, by all, I mean the Jew and the Gentile, he's going to bring us all home so that all will receive the blessing of the land.
The story of Ruth gives that passage, exactly.
Yeah. We have to stop there. So we'll start in verse 17 next week. Okay? Any other questions or comments?